All right, Kathy, we're all set when you are. KY 6 feet clear.
Well, good evening, everyone. This is Kilo 6 Sierra United November, and welcome to the outreach program sponsored by the South Coast Amateur Radio Service. This program has been established to help those wishing to learn more about our hobby and further assist those wishing to obtain license status. The first in our series will be an in-depth course pertaining to what one should know when studying for a technician class license. This course will be conducted with two sessions weekly, which will be at 7 p.m. at 2300 Zulu each Tuesday and at 7 p.m. 2300 Zulu each Sunday evening. For those that are licensed and wish either a refresher course or would just like to listen, please connect to our SCARA server at either EchoLink node number 96140 or IRLP node 9614. Let me pause for a moment. For those who are interested in obtaining your license for the first time, please contact Mike, KD0CDQ, via email at VOIP at VOIPnet.southcars.com to enroll in the class and be given directions as to the study material required and the manner you will be connecting into the course. The material being presented is formulated from data obtained from the ARRL and is simply being forwarded in a presentation form by SCARS. Should anyone take issue to some of the technical statements made and in keeping with not interrupting the class in session, please convey your comments or suggestions to the outreach program at VOIP at VOIPnet.southcars.com. Before we start this evening's program, it should be mentioned that the material being covered is based on the new Q&A pool effective July 1st, 2014. This means that this material should not be used for those that are planning on taking the test prior to the date shown, which obviously has passed. It should be further mentioned that this course covers only the requirements pertaining to the United States Part 97 rules and does not include other requirements that may be found in foreign countries. Should any other country other than the United States wish to have their own licensing sessions on this server, please drop us an email at VOIP at VOIPnet.southcars.com. Do we have any emergency or out of the ordinary business that needs to be handled before we start this evening's program? Hearing no emergency traffic or any out of the ordinary business, that's great. My name is Kathy. My call sign is Kilo 6 Sierra United November, and I am your opening moderator for this evening. My location is Port St. Lucie, where it's currently 84 degrees, high of 89. But it was a beautiful day and a beautiful evening. We have two instructors with us this evening. We have KD0CDQ from Olathe, Kansas, and we have Mr. Craig, WE2Q, and he's from the East Coast. So, with that, I'm going to throw it over your direction, Craig, for you to begin this evening's program, and thank both of you for being here. So, WE2Q from Kilo 6 Sierra United November, the first question, I believe, is yours.
This is WE2Q, Craig. Thank you, Kathy, for that introduction. I appreciate it. Always good to hear you in there. The first question for this evening comes from T7, the station equipment section of part of the question pool. T7A01 specifically. And the question is, what term describes the ability of a receiver to detect the presence of a signal? Read that carefully, to detect the presence of a signal. The answer here is sensitivity. Do not confuse that with selectivity. Sensitivity is normally defined as the minimum input signal required to produce a specified signal-to-noise ratio at the output of the receiver. The signal-to-noise ratio is the amount of noise that is on in the background in the air as compared to the actual signal that you're trying to look at. The signal-to-noise ratio is arguably the sensitivity, which is part of that signal-to-noise ratio, is arguably the most important specification in a radio. Selectivity is the next one. Selectivity is the ability to pull a signal out of a specific frequency out of that signal that is being able to be sensed by the radio itself. Again, do not confuse sensitivity with selectivity. Sensitivity is the ability to actually pick out the signal from or the entire range of signals from the background noise, and selectivity is the ability to zone in, if you will, or zero in on a specific frequency within that band that you're able to receive. Again, the question is, what term describes the ability of a receiver to detect the presence of a signal? The answer is sensitivity. Any questions there? I was hoping there'd be a question. All right, Mike, we'll turn it over to you for the next question.
Very good. Good evening. This is KD0CDQ, Mike, out here in sunny Kansas. And this information on this section we're doing today, the Tango 7, this is very practical. So tonight will be very practical, although we may make it complicated. I'm going to be reading Tango 7 Alpha 07. I'll let it drop and we'll come back in. Okay, the question reads, what is meant by the term PTT? We're not talking about PT boats here. What's meant by the term PTT? Now, they give you a very complicated selection here. The first selection is pre-transmission tuning to reduce transmitter harmonic emission. Wow. Precise tone transmissions used to limit repeater access to only certain signals. A primary transformer tuner used to match antennas. The push-to-talk function, which switches between receive and transmit. Now, that's the right answer, which is delta in this case, but as Kathy told you, those can swing around, so don't go by that. Now, this push-to-talk, that's what makes this miracle of radio work. Push-to-talk, which is abbreviated PTT, you will literally push the PTT switch on the microphone, closing a pair of electrical contacts that activate the transmitter. Once the transmitter is keyed, anything spoken into the microphone or keyed by a Morse key or generated by a computer getting sent out over the air. So this rig will probably light up. Your radio will probably light up a transmitter or something, let you know it's working. While push-to-talk works fine, using it for long periods of time can sure out your thumb. It also requires one hand to hold a microphone. The solution is called a VOX, which is in your radio, which is a voice operated transmission. There's a switch you throw which can lock it on. I'll warn you about PTTs. You may not realize you have it on and people can hear your conversation, so I don't use the push-to-talk button, the VOX. But if you key it too long, and this is important for new hams, if you key it too long, maybe 3 minutes, you can cause a problem. You can disconnect repeaters and relays to prevent them from overheating or overheating your radio. So I don't use that VOX. I'm afraid the background noise might kick it on. So when you push to talk, as you'll notice, we try to limit our transmissions to 3 minutes even here. And I've had my handheld get so warm because I've been transmitting so much that it actually will get warm to the touch. Is there any questions about what the term PTT means or what the push to talk button does? Over.
Six, Victor, sir.
Right ahead, Gordon.
Boy, that was nice coverage. Thank you, Mike. KY6V here. The automatic Vox that Mike was talking about can get you into trouble. Because the moment that the microphone cartridge hears a sound, it's going to put your transmitter into transmit mode, and anything in that sound wave will be transmitted. Now think about this. You've got your television on in the other room, and the microphone hears it. It keys the transmitter. Your dog barks at the mailman. It keys the transmitter. Your wife yells at you, and it keys the transmitter. So be careful. Thanks, Mike. KY6V.
Okay, not hearing any question, I'm going to swing it back over to Craig. Craig, you're up. Over.
Thank you, Mike. WE2Q again. And before I do the next question, I just had a comment. It was asked earlier about how to study for some of these questions and whether they should be memorized. Another method that is pretty good for studying all of the questions in the question pool, you might want to sit down and either type with a word processor or write them down or just say them to yourself in the form of a statement instead of a question. For instance, my first question was, which term describes the ability of a receiver to detect the presence of a signal? The answer here is sensitivity. We'll turn that into a statement. And the statement could be, sensitivity is the term that describes the ability of a receiver to detect the presence of a signal. And if you wrote each one of these down, you could just read them almost as a textbook. So my next question is T7A08. And in the form of a statement, that would be modulation describes combining speech with an RF carrier signal. So the question actually is which of the following describes combining speech with an RF carrier signal? And the answer is modulation. Modulation is the ability to impose, if you will, information upon a carrier. If you were to just transmit a carrier, you would have no intelligible sound or modulation on it at all. It would just be a flat tone according to how the radio interprets it, or it may just be static if no modulation is done. With your technician license, you'll probably either be using CW or a VHF-UHF transmitter on the 2-meter 440 side. And if you're doing that, you'll be doing sideband. That's not the modulation, that's the carrier type. The modulation used on that is FM, frequency modulation. And what that means is it modifies the base carrier frequency with the frequency of your speech. The frequency of your speech will vary from about 600 to around 16,000, and that speech modulation or that speech tone will be superimposed upon the actual frequency that you're transmitting, actually changing the frequency that's being received. And the difference between the carrier frequency and that frequency being received will be changed back into audio so that you can hear your speech back to yourself or back from the receiver. It's called modulation. It's modulating or modifying the carrier frequency. There are a number of modulation types which you'll find as you progress through ham radio. The most common one you'll be using early on is frequency modulation. Again, which of the following describes combining speech with an RF carrier signal? And that answer is modulation. Any questions there? Very good. Back to you, Mike.
Okay, Craig, the question we're going to hit on now is Tango 7 Alpha 09. And 09 reads, which of the following devices is most useful for VHF weak signal communication? Is it a quarter wave vertical antenna, a multi-mode VHF transceiver, an omnidirectional antenna, a mobile VHF FM transceiver? Now again, it's kind of wordy there, but the answer is the second one, the Bravo. A multi-mode VHF transceiver. Now sometimes these are the handhelds we talk about. Some people call them HTs. Some people call them walkie-talkies. Don't get confused by the name. It's just a multi-mode VHF transceiver. And a VHF means very high frequency. It receives, the device receives and transmits at a very high frequency. Now, I'm going to give you some numbers here. You don't need to know this, but this is good for background. The wavelength, how long is this wave we're talking about from VHF transceiver? It varies between, say, 39 inches up to 393 inches long. Now, if you can figure 39 inches, that's a yardstick. So a wave can be that long, and if a wave is that long that you're sending out, or longer yet, you can see where you can run into problems with bouncing off of things. such as buildings or trees or anything that could block your signal. So if you're ever having a problem and people can't hear you or they're getting a lot of noise, just change your position slightly, because these signals are long, your antennas are short, and they're only taking part of the wave. I won't get into that on this question. But while fun with a VHF handheld radio, you can actually hear commercial aircraft, you can hear general aviation. The little airplanes that fly around the neighborhood, they're on our same radios that we're using. And so are, navigation beacons and emergency signals. So you may find in your area there's more things you can listen to, but you won't be transmitting back to the aircraft, certainly. But you can listen to more than just our chatter between ham radio operators. So a multi-mode VHF transceiver is what you would use for weak signal transmission, and it's only from 1 to 5 watts, very slow, very low wattage, and it'll only probably go to the horizon, unless it hits the repeater, then you can swing a little further than the horizon. Any questions on that one? Over.
I have a comment.
Go ahead, Lyman, with your comment.
My grandfather gave me a Grundig 750. Is that kind of like what you were talking about?
Yes. Is that one that you can hold in your hand, or is it one that goes like on the desktop? Which is that one, please?
Big one that you can put on the desktop, not a handheld, but one of the ones that you can listen to while you're just sitting there.
Yes, some of the older radios were kind of big. Yes, in your career you'll have both. You'll have the handhelds that you take with you, and you'll have the ones in your ham shack, which you'll have right in your house, and they'll just be stationary. So there's different kinds of radios, and that sounds like that's a desktop. I thought that it was. But then you'll probably be getting into both. And also, when you get your own car or motorcycle, you'll have an amateur radio in your car or on your motorcycle as well. It goes with you. Where you go, it goes. Any other comments about your multi-mode VHF transceivers? Okay, not hearing anything else, I'm going to throw it over to Craig. Throw it back to the East Coast. Take it away.
Well, I got it way over here in the East Coast. Wow, Lyman, if that's a Grundig Satellite 750, that's an impressive radio, a very, very nice radio. I wish I had one. A great radio. Have fun with it. That's great. My next question is T7A11. This one's actually pretty straightforward, pretty easy, with a little bit of knowledge, not too much to say about it. But the question is, where is an RF preamplifier installed? It's between the antenna and the receiver. If you think about that for a minute, where is an RF preamplifier installed? RF is a radio frequency. That's what we're receiving from our antenna. And what we're trying to do is amplify that signal coming off the antenna so that the radio can use it easily. So that the sensitivity of the radio that we talked about earlier can be maximized to pull that signal out of the RF signal that's available. So the amplifier is a preamplifier. It amplifies the signal prior to the radio seeing the signal itself. It preamplifies it before the radio. Pre means before. So simply the question again is, where is an RF preamplifier installed? It's between the antenna and the receiver. Any questions on that? Back to you, Michael.
Okay, now we're getting into the friendly stuff where you've got to be nice to your neighbors and how to stay nice with your neighbors. We're talking about station equipment, receivers, transceivers, modulation, transverses, low power and weak signal operation, transmit and receive amplifiers, all kind of stuff. But it all breaks down. It's like eating a horse, one bite at a time. We're now going to look at Tango 7, Bravo 04. And that one reads, now we're getting into things that are practical, things around you. Which of the following is a way to reduce or eliminate interference by an amateur transmitter to a nearby telephone? Now we're talking about telephone in your home or maybe a telephone in a neighbor's home that's quite close to you. Now the choices they give you is put a filter on the amateur transmitter, reduce the microphone gain, reduce the SWR, which is short wave ratio, on your transmitter, on a transmission line, rather. And the last selection is put an RF filter on the telephone. Well, the answer is to put an RF filter on your telephone. Now, we don't want to get you too confused. We're going to let it drop and come back. There are different kinds of low RF filters. And usually, at least in our case, when we first got internet service in the home, the phone company sent me three different filters. And these filters were to use in your home in case you had a telephone that interfered, your computer interfered with the telephone. You could put these filters. Just a little box. They're a little box that goes into the telephone box on the wall, and it's got an out cables, and the outlines are what you hook your phone into. So you plug your phone into this little box, and the little box plugs into the outlet on the wall, and it'll keep interference, buzzes and hums and clicks and all that funny stuff. So I'm not going to get into the different kinds of filters. There's many kinds. But the phone company, if they don't supply one and you or your neighbor is having trouble hearing, getting noises from your amateur radio, either check with your phone company, see if they'll send you one for free, or wiggle on down to the electronics store and get a filter and tell them what you need it for. Telephone interference, they'll know what you mean. They'll say right on the package. And it'd be a kind thing if you have a neighbor that's getting interference from your radio, which isn't likely. But if you do, I would buy it for them and give it to them. They'll appreciate that you took interest and didn't just blow it off. You know, people don't like that when you just say, oh, well, I can't help it, my radio. No, you can't help it. And being a good neighbor, which ham radio people are, being a good neighbor, if a neighbor has a problem, do what you can to help them. We want to keep the hobby happy. Okay? Any questions with that? Over.
Quick comment?
Yes, Craig, go ahead.
Mike, I may have missed it. Maybe I wasn't listening as hard as I should have. But when you're referring to telephones here, you're talking about those old antiquated landline systems, I believe, because if I'm right, if you could clarify that.
Yes, Lyman, what are you saying by landlines? You know, people have phones in their home. We still have phones in our home, and I use my cell phone most of the time. But in your home, you have those little phone boxes, and people have, you're at your grandmother's house. She may have one of those in her home, where her phone is actually plugged into the wall, a little box on the wall. Now, I'm not going to make fun of those little boxes, because when I worked for the phone company, that's what we did. We didn't have any wireless. Everything was wired, coming in from the pole outside, into the house, into all the rooms of the house, and all over the place. If you wanted a phone, you had to drag a wire through there. Even in office buildings, we drug a lot of big, fat cables in office buildings. So, yes, what we're talking about is what we call a landline, or phones that have to plug in the wall, wired phones. Any questions on that?
Six, Victor.
Go ahead, Gordon.
Yeah, it may be going a little further, too. Craig, to the best of my knowledge, and I'll confirm this in just a second with Mike, I think he's on DSL. So you got some additional complications there. You are on a DSL system, is that correct, Mike, where your telephone and your internet come in on the same cable, over?
Yes, indeed. Through the magic, my telephone and our computer comes in on the same line, DSL. Yes, that's so.
Okay. Just wanted to clarify that. Greg, any other comments on that? KY6V, over.
If you're asking for comments on the DSL, the DSL actually, as Mike, I think, indicated, that when they install those, they actually give you a set of ferrite filters to go on the lines that come off the cable box, to keep the internet from interfering with the box itself. The same way as we would filter out ham radio from a landline or any other wire-connected device. My comment was purely because of the wireless technologies and all of the smartphones. Unfortunately, there's no filters we could put on those if we were interfering. But yeah, DSL is notorious for having interference on the phone, and they do include those ferrite filter systems when they install the system. Mike, back to you.
Okay, Greg, I think you're up with the next question. So I'm going to throw it back to you. Take it away.
Very good. Thank you, sir. And this question is T7Baker07. Which of the following may be useful in correcting a radio frequency interference problem? And I'm going to read them all. Snap-on ferrite chokes, low-pass and high-pass filters, band reject and band pass filters. And the answer here is all of the above. Sounds like it could be a complicated answer, but it really isn't. If you go back to Sunday's comments about inductors, ferrite chokes with coils of wire around them can be used quite nicely to filter out interference from things like ham radio on telephones. The ferrite choke is made from a ferrite core and snaps over the wire. Low-pass filters will do just that. They will pass a signal that is below a certain frequency. A high-pass filter passes frequencies above a certain frequency. A band reject will do just as it seems to sound. You have a band of frequencies that it will not allow to pass through the filter. And a band pass filter does just the opposite. It allows only a certain band of frequencies or a certain range of frequencies to be passed through that filter. So according to the problem that you're trying to correct, the frequency that you're trying to either eliminate or allow to pass through, you can use these in combinations to successfully either block or allow that frequency through. Again, the question is, which of the following may be useful in correcting a radio frequency interference problem? That is snap-on ferrite chokes, low-pass and high-pass filters, band reject and band-pass filtering. They're all capable of helping with that problem. So the answer is all of these choices are correct. Any questions?
I feel like this question was on the QRZ practice test, and I just feel like it was it.
I'm sorry, Lyman, if your question was, is that on the QRZ practice test? It should be. All of the questions are there, and as you take each one of the exams, you may not see that specific question, but if you take enough of the exams, you are sure to see that. It will actually keep track of what you're doing, and you will eventually see that question itself. All of the questions are on QRZ, but as I say, if you've only taken a couple of those tests, you may not have seen that question in particular. Was that what you were asking?
Yes, and I did remember that question today when that was like my, because I went over the test over and over, and that was one of the last times I did the test. So, yeah.
Very good. Any other questions at all or comments? All right, Mike, it seems to be yours.
Okay, we're now going to hit Tango 7, Bravo 08. Now, Lyman and others, I keep using the Tangos and the Alphas because I want you to get used to that. I would download a chart off the internet with the proper coding to use, because even policemen use their girlfriends' names and get in trouble with their wives. They use all kind of different things that don't really make any sense. But if you're going to be an amateur radio operator, we stay with the designated proper international signals that, well, they're actually American. So. Yes, indeed. Well, we want to make sure we use those codes. Okay, now with that question, Tango 7, Bravo 08, we're going to be courteous here. We're talking about things with neighbors, keeping the peace. What should you do if something in your neighbor's home is causing harmful interference to your amateur station? Uh-oh, you're getting problems coming back to you. Letting it drop? Now, with this question, you don't want to be hasty answering this question because you got to read the whole thing. They give you, well, Alpha is, work with your neighbor to identify the offending device. Bravo, politely inform your neighbor about the rules that prohibit the use of devices which cause interference. I'll go into that a little bit later. Charlie, check your station and make sure it meets the standards of good amateur practice. You know, make sure your radio's in good shape. And Delta is, all of these choices are correct. And that's right with this one, so don't get tricked. All of these choices are correct. You want to work with your neighbors to identify any offending devices. Sometimes fluorescent lighting or a space heater Oh, a host of things could be causing interference. A mixer, a blender, and you're getting the noise coming back to you. But you always want to be, like it says in the second selection, be polite with your neighbor. And now some devices they have may be kind of cheap. You know, we buy a lot of cheap stuff around the house. And it may not have the proper protections that they should have that the FCC requires. So sometimes some of their equipment may be leaking noises. And we have to try to identify that and do what we can with the neighbor. But the Charlie selection, check your station and make sure you meet the standards of good amateur practice. That's the first thing to do. Make sure you're operating your radio properly. Make sure you're not putting out anything that could cause other people harm. What they mean by this whole thing is that the FCC has rules. The Federal Communication Commission has rules. And your operator is, and not to interfere with other people's homes, and they shouldn't be interfering with us. Ham radio shouldn't interfere with their operation, and of course theirs should not interfere with ours. So just being a good neighbor, and when you do run into a problem, it may just mean moving your radio. Put it up on a different shelf, or turn it a different way, or your antenna, turn it a different way, or put it in a different location, something. It's usually things that are very simple, but we make it complicated. I'll tell you, Lyman, a lot of us make things complicated trying to fix problems when start with the simple. Always start with the simple. So any questions on that one? Over. Okay, I'm not hearing anything, so I'm going to bounce it back to you, Craig. Take it on.
Thank you, sir. WE2Q. My next question is Tango 7, Bravo 09. And Mike, if I can also expand on your comment about the phonetic alphabet, if you're going to download one, try looking for the ITU phonetic alphabet. I don't know if we have it on our website. Maybe Gordon can comment on that later. But if not, the ITU phonetic alphabet is probably the one that we should be using. My question, Tango 7, Bravo 09. What is a Part 15 device? The answer is an unlicensed device that may emit low-powered radio signals on frequencies used by a licensed service. Again, what is a Part 15 device? An unlicensed device that may emit low-powered radio signals on frequencies used by a licensed service. Part 15 is another part of a very large document of the federal government called the Code of Federal Regulations, the CFR. The CFR is divided into 50 titles. Those titles regulate just about everything that the federal government does in every branch thereof. Title 47 is the telecommunications section of the CFR. And there are three parts of Title 47 that specifically relate to the FCC, or the FCC relates to those parts. And those are Part 15, Part 90, and Part 97. Part 15 is concerned with unlicensed broadcasts, superior submissions, low power emissions, and that sort of thing. Part 97 is wireless communications for business and non-federal governments. And Part 97 is amateur radio. So most of what we deal with is from CFR Title 47, Part 97. And you'll hear all the time of people in ham radio referring to Part 97 rules and regulations. Part 15 also plays a part, and that part is for what I just mentioned, low-power devices, unlicensed devices, and some licensed radios are putting out low power, and superior submissions. So when we talk about superior submissions, that may be Part 15, and it may be Part 97. So going back to the question, what is a Part 15 device? It's an unlicensed device that may emit low-power radio signals on frequencies used by licensed services. This doesn't mean that these are illegal, by the way. They are just covered under a section where they are low-powered devices and should not produce superior submissions or interfere with our radios. And just one last question, if you ever want to get to become amazed of how big that is, try to look up the Code of Federal Regulations on the internet and just peruse through the thousands upon thousands of pages. It's unbelievable. Mike, we'll turn it back to you.
Okay, now it used to be that all of these devices like phones and radios that we bought in our homes would have a sticker on them that would say that Part 15, that Part 15 device, in other words, safe device. But I was looking at the phones that we have here, and they must only be on the box now. It looks like they don't put them on the radios and the phones. I'll tell you, these phones come from the strangest places. You know, we know they're on this planet. Nothing's coming from out of space. But they come from countries that are far, far away. So we have to rely on the manufacturers to properly make the radios and the phones and the blenders and television sets that they don't interfere with other things. We have to hope that they're good. And pretty well I have that covered. We're going to go into the Tango 7 Charlie section 03, hitting number 3 now. Now, what, in general terms, is standing wave ratio, that SWR? You're going to hear that a lot. Guys talk about SWR all the time. So what is the general term standing wave ratio, SWR? Is it a measure of how well a load is matched to a transmission line? Is it the ratio of high to low impedance in a feed line? Is it the transmitter efficiency ratio? Is it an indicator of the quality of your station's ground connection? Well, the standing wave ratio, the SWR alpha, the first one here is correct, a measure of how well a load is matched to a transmission line. Now, to measure the SWR, the standing wave ratio, in a feed line, a special type of meter is needed. On some radios, like the desktops, they may have them built in, or you may have a little separate little box, and it's got they might be digital now, but mine have analog. They got needles that move on them. The SWR meter is used for that purpose, just to make sure the device is placed. It's placed in the feed line, usually right at the output of the radio. So when you come out of the radio with your coax cable, that's where you would hook your SWR meter. And the other end of the SWR meter, you'd hook a coax cable to, and that goes to your antenna. And the SWR meter measures the power flowing towards the antenna, forward. That's going forward and toward the transmitter. And when it's going towards the transmitter, that's the reflective or reverse. So you'll have two needles usually. One will show the forward and one will show the reflective or reverse power that's coming one way or the other. And the meter is calibrated to show the SWR of power. And when you get one of those, got little knobs, that's kind of cool. I like to turn knobs. Maybe some of the new ones are electronic and they tune themselves. But I like the ones that you can, SWRs, you can tune yourself. And I do that all the time.
Or UJL.
Okay, if you have to do that, the SWR is a little tool to use. So it measures of how well a load is matched to the transmission line. That's what a standing wave ratio term refers to. Any questions?
For you, JL.
Go right ahead.
Yes, sir. And keyed earlier because you dropped out, and I thought you had unkeyed. I've had a few dropouts on here. My question is something I thought I heard way back when I first got a license. Is it better to measure that at the antenna end when possible? Just a question. Is it better?
Well, there's the units that you can hand carry, which are really neat. They run about $300-$400. You can actually check out your antenna, how the signal is going and whatnot with those. But the little box I have, I've got a couple of them. One just a little old Radio Shack thing, and you can adjust it. The other one, like on the HF radio, it's built right into the radio. And I just make, what you want to do is make sure that your current's going out, and you're not being blocked, and I don't want to get too deep in explaining it, but you just have to turn your needles and get the thing to where you're throwing power out, but you're not reflecting. It's not coming back in. So it's a little box, or it's in your radio, like an HF situation. So it goes from the radio, from the coax coming out of the radio, to the SWR meter, and then from the SWR meter to the antenna. It's just getting everything in line. Many people have automatic. There's automatic ones, but some people aren't too happy with them, but other people are. So there's everything's going automatic. Everything's going where you just plug things in. And so I hope that answered your question.
Six, Victor.
Go right ahead, Gordon.
Yeah, I want to wave at Jim. That is an excellent question, Jim. And it's a very, very deep subject. And if you'd like to talk about that, we can do that one-on-one rather than tying up the class. But the fail-safe position is to put the SWR bridge between your transmission line and the antenna at the antenna feed point. Okay, now this is not only, not always practical, Jim. You know, if you got a 200-foot tower, you got a 20-foot mast on top of that tower, and you got an antenna on the top, are you going to, try to crawl up there and put a bridge in? I don't think so. But there's ways to get around that. There are principles that can be used to use multiple half waves of coax line between the antenna and the transceiver so that the SWR read at the transceiver will be identical to the antenna. It's a big subject, Jim. Over.
Excellent answer. I'm rusty, but I thought I remember hearing that back when I started. I appreciate the time and for you, JL.
Yeah, I'd be happy to talk with you about that later if you'd like. Back to you, Mike, and thank you, KY6V.
Yes, and there's no end to the breakfast conversations you can have with guys just talking about SWR. It goes on and on. There is no end. There is no end to that topic, I'll tell you. And just about a month during the field day a month ago, a fellow had a brand new, wow, what a neat rig he had. And he's an older gentleman. He says, all I got to do is spend money on things that I like to have for a hobby. Because it was so fine a unit that most of us couldn't figure what all those gadgets were on there. But there's a lot to it. Okay, Greg, going back to you. Your turn. Over.
Thank you, Mike. Appreciate it. My next question is Tango 7, Charlie 07. That's T7C07. What happens to power loss in a feed line? The answer is it's converted into heat. In many devices, when there is power loss, it is converted into heat. And in some devices, we actually utilize that that property, if you will. Toasters, for instance, or heaters, electric heaters, will take a resistive component and pass electricity through it and use that electricity to produce heat. And the same thing is actually happening in our cables. The feed line itself actually heats up as power is passed through it. And it's a characteristic property of every cable type. There are lots of coaxial cables and feed lines, etc., and they all have characteristics of resistance, velocity factor changes, etc. And if you look up the properties of the cables online or at the manufacturer's site, you will find the resistance of that cable listed, the velocity factor listed, and the loss of power or signal per foot of cable. So the longer the cable you have, the more loss you're going to actually impose upon the signal. It is conceivable actually to have a cable long enough so that by the time you got to the antenna, you would have nothing coming out at all, which would not be effective whatsoever. And for that reason, you need to try to select a cable for the distance you're going to run to the antenna, one that matches to your radio. Usually we're looking at a 50-ohm cable. And check the loss per foot of cable when you're trying to determine the cable you're going to use for an antenna that is a distance away. Short runs of cable generally make no difference. If you're looking at a cable to run in your car or you're talking about running from perhaps your second-story bedroom up to the attic, only a few feet away. The cable may not make a big difference. But if it's a good distance away, then you can have quite a loss of signal power just from the cable itself, not even talking about poor connections or mismatches at the antenna or anything else. And that loss of power is going to go up in heat. It's going to radiate as heat, just like any other coil. Any questions on that?
For you, JL, again.
Go right ahead.
Yes, sir. Is it not true that A and B would also apply?
I'm not sure what you're referring to. You're asking, would A and B apply? Oh, in the answer group. Okay, I'm with you now. Let me look at that. I'm sitting here thinking, what's the A and the B, you know, being really, really thick. What happens to power lost in the feed line? It increases the SWR. It comes back into the transmitter and causes damage. Well, the answer is C. It is converted into heat. I would just stay with that answer. The others may be marginally in there, but the answer is it converts into heat. I would stay with that as far as power loss in the feed line. What do you think on that, Craig?
Yeah, the only answer that is correct is the converted into heat. The first one, it increases the SWR. That's really not true. Power loss in the feed line is only due to the resistive characteristics and the dielectric constants of the cable itself. The SWR almost entirely comes from the impedance matching of the antenna. And the type of antenna and the type of feed line that's being used will affect it very little. The type of feed line will affect the SWR only marginally. And it comes back to your transmitter and could cause damage. That is if the SWR is high. That means that the standing wave ratio would be coming back down your line across the shield, or back down the shield to your radio. Which is why it's important to have a balun on anything that you might expect to have that a back voltage coming back to you. But as far as power loss in the feed line, the only really correct answer here is it's converted into heat loss. Does that satisfy your curiosity?
Yes, sir. And it's totally an error in the way I read the question. I was thinking in terms of SWR, and it pertains to, I guess, high resistance, nothing else. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. I can see where that can be confusing. It certainly would. A poor SWR, as well as a resistive feed line, can cause a signal loss, for sure, at the antenna, but not a power loss. That's purely due to the characteristics of the feed line. Back to you, Mike.
Okay, we're going to hit the last question now. And we're going to talk about a tool that after you get a screwdriver, this is the next tool to buy. We're looking at Tango 7, Delta 07. So we're in the Delta field now. And it says, which of the following measurements are commonly made with a multimeter? A multimeter? The first selection is SWR or RF power. Next is signal strength and noise. And then the third selection is impedance and reactance. And the last selection is voltage and resistance. And a multimeter can read voltage and resistance. That's your answer. Now, a multimeter measures electrical properties such as AC or DC voltage, current and resistance. Rather than having separate meters, you could have separate ones. They have a device combined, and it's a voltmeter, an ammeter, and an ohmmeter all together. That's why they call it multimeter. Now, electricians and the general public might use it on batteries, components, switches, power supplies, and motors to diagnose electrical malfunctions and narrow down their causes. But when you get into amateur radio, you're going to find a multimeter is extremely useful. And you don't have to be expensive ones, because the first one you might blow anyway. You might have damaged the first one, so I wouldn't get too expensive with the first one you get. And there's two main kinds of multimeters, analog and digital. You're going to hear those words. Analog is the ones with the needles that go back and forth, and digital is the ones that read out numbers. on a digital device, which is the thing you're going to see most common now. It's called, it has an LCD screen, you know, one of those screens that gives a straightforward decimal readout, while an analog display moves a bar through a scale of numbers and must be interpreted. You have to kind of look at the needle, where it's going. Either type will work over a specific range of each measurement, and users should select one that's compatible with what you're actually going to be doing. For low voltage power, like what we're working on, low voltage sources to high voltage car batteries, there would be different ones, but I use it on the car battery too, so it's 12 volt, it's not really that high. So multimeters are specified with a selective range, so consumers should make sure they get an appropriate one. So if somebody gave you a nice radio there, who knows, somebody might give you a nice multimeter. That's a nice thing they get for a Christmas gift. Multimeters are so useful. I even check batteries when I buy new batteries. I always check one in the pack to make sure they're okay. And when my radio, something's going awry and something, I check the battery, see what the voltage is. So I even use it for little things like checking little cheap things like batteries. But is there any other questions on multimeters, voltage and resistance? Please go now. I think we're back in there again. Yeah, my little stopwatch went to 3 and a couple of seconds beyond, and the thing popped on me. I'm sorry for that. Anybody have any questions about anything covered? And I'd like that Lyman mentioned, does he have to memorize the answers? Well, maybe. We're all different. Some of us are visual. If we look at a question long enough, it burns into our brains. Some of us have to write something out. We have to write it on paper, like when you do something wrong at school, Lyman, and the teacher tells you to write something so many times. Or other people, just, as Craig said earlier, he's an audio person. He likes to hear things. So he reads the questions aloud, I would guess, and the answer. He likes to hear it. There's all different ways of learning, and we all have to learn what works best for us. Even though the guy right next to us might have a different way of learning, they all work. So if any of the questions are kind of tricky, memorize the question and the answer. There'll be a clue often. There's often a clue in the question that gives you the answer. So you got to read the question cautiously, and again, stick with the answer that you see is right. Don't doubt yourself. It's somewhere inside of our brain, the answer. We don't know what the answer is, but our little brains do. Anybody have any questions? Over.
A comment.
Yes, Lyman, go ahead.
You know how, well, before we did this one, we were like 62.9% out of this. How many more Sundays and Tuesdays do we have? Because I want to have a lot more, because this is really enjoyable, just sitting down and listening and writing everything down. So how many more do we have? Over.
Okay, I don't have it in front of me, but as I recall, you're going to have Kathy and Gordon back on next Sunday. Is there two more classes, Gordon? I don't have it in front of me. How many more classes are there, please?
Yes, sir, Mike. There are two classes after this evening. They'll be class 7 and 8. There are 8 classes in total. So tonight's endeavor, Lyman, you are at 75% through the course. Sunday night, when you join us, you will be at 87.5. And on Tuesday, you will hear the band play. Lyman, over.
When you say hear the band play, does that mean like, or all goodbyes and congratulations and all?
Well, I don't know. Depends on how we handle it this year, sir. It may be a pomp and circumstances, you know, when you graduate, Lyman, over.
All right, well, I get that now. Thank you.
Thanks. It's been a joy having you with us, Lyman. Mike, back to you, KY6V, over.
Yes, the long-faced government bureaucrats in the FCC don't allow us to play any music, although I think our voices are very musical. Kathy's voice is very musical, don't you think so, Lyman? So if you had a teacher with a musical voice, that would be really fun. It would be something to do besides sit there and snore. So anytime you need help, Lyman, with these questions, during the week, you can email us at the VOIP address with the questions or anything you have. We're here for you. It's not just for this hour here and an hour there. We're just at the top of the hour. But if you have any questions, email us, and we're very glad, especially Gordon. He's right on top of it. He'll answer and help you back with any questions that you may have. So if you have a question that's throwing you for a loop, ask us for more information on it. Maybe we'll give you a clue that will help you remember it. Okay, we're at the end of this. Does anyone else have any comment before we ask Gordon to turn off the recorders? Over.
I'm not sure what the long pause is here. Mike, are you ready for me to start closing?
Yes, that's what I asked for. I asked for the silence so you can turn off your recorders. Over.
All right. Give me about 30 seconds. I can probably do it a little shorter than that. Be right back with you, Mike, KY6V.